Hello and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, joined as always by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, anti-Semitism on the left. And Richard, this conversation is occasioned by a controversy that's been raging on the left for the past few weeks, stemming primarily from some remarks made by Ilhan Omar, the freshman congresswoman from Minnesota, who in public remarks recently has characterized American support for Israel as being driven largely by financial considerations. This is an argument that we've heard before, that groups like AIPAC are essentially buying support for Israel. And she's also saying that there's a sort of dual loyalty, in her words, allegiance to a foreign country at work here. Now, this obviously is especially heated because it involves issues of ethnic and religious identities, but it is of a piece with arguments that we often hear in American politics. I mean, if you substitute the NRA for AIPAC and gun rights for Israel, the argument still more or less grafts, suggesting that all such interests are inherently suspect. So how should we navigate those kinds of arguments?
Nobody really knows what to do with charges of prejudice, and I think I'm as reluctant as anybody else to speak categorically. But the first thing I do when somebody makes a charge against somebody else is to say whether or not, if you reverse the tables, the charge could be made against them. So Ms. Omar is a devout supporter of the Palestinian cause, I am sure, and Lord knows exactly what version of it she supports. So, for example, does she support a two-state solution, or does she support a one-state solution? So the question that you start to ask is, all right, now you take these particular provisions. Does that mean that you've given your allegiances to a foreign state? Does that mean that you are in the thrall of money from people who've been your donors in order to engage in these kinds of situations? At which point you then get the kind of dilemma which says, okay, if you insist that you could be independent and that your views are objectively defensible, why is it that you don't give that credit to somebody on the other side of the argument? And so what happens is, and one of the things that's so strange about the whole anti-Semitism debate is that it's only a one-directional situation. Anybody who wants to attack Jewish groups and Jewish people for being essentially excessively pro-Israeli never gets a strong charge against them in the same way you do if you're running in the opposite direction. So could you imagine what would happen if people started to make really strong anti-Muslim tweets in the public arena? Things would be very, very different and very, very hostile. I think in this case of the situation with the kid from Covington School who sits there and he's attacked and kind of harassed by this Indian chief who's a well-known activist at the time. And the reaction after a while was maybe if he stood there stolidly, he wasn't engaged in sort of a hatred form of speech. But what was so troublesome about the whole debate is the guy who was on the other side of that was in fact engaged in provocation and in indecent behavior and was not condemned for that. So what I do is I sometimes feel as though this table has become tilted in one direction, where one group thinks itself to be relatively invulnerable to political situation and the other one is sitting there trying to defend itself. So that's the first thing I think that I find kind of worrisome. The second thing that I think I find kind of worrisome is the fact that I do not understand why the Democratic Party, which is heavily dependent upon Jewish loyalties, is constantly willing to water things down in these circumstances as if it's going to make the problem disappear. So the original resolution was very pointed about a particular person, everybody knew who she was, who started making charges which essentially are false. AIPAC is a political organization, but so are lots of other groups. Jewish opinion is notoriously divided with respect to Israel. The idea that it's a behemoth is simply wrong on these things. All right. And so what you do is you want to point this out. And then all of a sudden it becomes a generalized situation where everybody's against hatred by everybody against everybody else. Well, it's one thing to condemn somebody or to call somebody out for doing something wrong. And it's another thing for essentially saying that everybody agrees that good behavior is extremely important, because the general statement that you make essentially is an implicit exoneration of her for any kind of wrongful conduct. And I think that that is wrong. I think that people have to be quite hard on somebody who starts to talk in that particular fashion. I recall reading a nice column by Rahm Emanuel, which starts off with the general stuff about how uneasy Jews are about the history of anti-Semitism. And then he says, look, you know, you actually look at the way in which the Jewish sentiment is divided. There are many people in this country who are strong for Netanyahu. There are many people in this country who are strong against them. There's some Jewish people who think that annexation of the West Bank would be a great idea. Others who think that it is absolutely intolerable. There's some people who want to pull out. Some people want to make the status quo. Some who want to negotiate with the Palestinians. Some who don't want to know. That's the sign of an intelligent debate. I wish there were the same kind of disagreement on the other side, so that there have been people who essentially have largely pro-Palestinian sympathies would have said, wait a second, Ms. Omar, we believe that this is a source on which we have to have lots of views, but it turns out that we're not as monolithic as you make us seem to be. But I just don't see that happening. And so as far as I'm concerned, this is one of these situations where if you remain silent, what you do is you give a kind of a big boost. And if you dilute resolutions that are pointed, the implicit statement is you can do it again. You'll get away with it. We'll have another general resolution, but we're never going to call you out. When the Republicans had that stuff with the Representative King or whatever his name was, they threw him off all the committees. This woman still sits on the Foreign Affairs Committee.
When support for Israel isn't being portrayed as kind of mercenary in nature, the critics often portray it as kind of irrational. So one thing you hear sometimes from critics on the left is, oh, Republicans support Israel because they have this base of evangelical Christians who all think that Israel needed to be reestablished to start the countdown to the Christian apocalypse. So here the rationale is not so much venal, it's just kind of superstitious. So, Richard, as someone who is not taking financial contributions on the matter, who's not an evangelical Christian, is there a pragmatic case about the national interest that you'd make to explain why this has been such an enduring American interest?
Well, I actually do not think that the coming of the Messiah in the land of Egypt or land of Israel, now possessed by Zeus, letting in, is particularly important in this case. When I spend a lot of time basically devoting free services to people like the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, because I think what happens in many cases is the evangelicals are in fact themselves being marginalized in the United States, and I think the most conspicuous version of that is the amount of sheer venom that is directed to people like the fellow Jack Phillips, who was involved with the Masterpiece Cake Theater, where people don't mind sending hate speech to somebody because he doesn't want to make a cake which is in violation of his religious conviction. And I think what's happened in many of the cases is that the evangelicals essentially understand what the Israeli situation is about because they feel that they are in many ways in exactly the same kind of position. And so there's this kind of weird alliance. I regard myself as part of it. The last thing anybody would ever accuse me of or praise me for being is an evangelical Christian. It's absolutely no part of my own life. But one of the things that you have to believe in if you believe in religious liberty is people have to have thoughts and views that are different from your own. Sometimes they have to be thoughts and views that you regard as positively abhorrent. If you go back to the early phrases on this, the ones that I learned in Sunday school back in the 1950s, we always used to talk about toleration. And the thing to understand about toleration is you don't tolerate people whom you like. You don't tolerate people with whom you agree. You tolerate those people to do something when you actually disagree with what it is that they want to do, but have concluded yourself that it is better for you to let them go their way and for you to go your way than for you to try to impose your particular views on them in any kind of a public debate. And I think what's happened is we've lost that sense of toleration on these respective differences. And so what you see now is following kind of argument, which I regard as basically wrongheaded, which it says, well, if you want to go worship, do it in whatever way you want. But the moment you decide to open a store, then in effect what you have to do is to recognize that you're going to be subject to an anti-discrimination obligation that forces you to engage in conduct against your Congress. I fail to see why those two things should be connected. It seems to me that anybody's entitled to open up any business they want under these circumstances. And even within the framework of the general anti-discrimination laws, I would say that religious convictions are a good reason to override them. I'm not a fan of the anti-discrimination laws generally because I think, in effect, in the competitive market, you don't want to worry about these things at all. But the current opinion is we just are going to force you to do all of this stuff, because we have a compelling state interest to make sure that everybody is one on this particular issue. And it's that kind of demand for consensus that is a mistake. And so I'm going to go back to one of the things that distinguishes discrimination from force when lots of people want to call them to say. So if there's one guy out there who doesn't like you and he's intent upon killing you, he's a real threat. And the fact that everybody else in the world is willing to applaud or to tolerate your actions doesn't mean that you're safe. But if there's one person in the world who doesn't want to do business with you, and then 99.9% of the population that does want to do business with you, then in effect, you do not have to have unanimity. So unanimity is necessary for a social contract. And when it turns out that you're worried about attacks, force, violence of one kind or another, you do not need unanimity on this in competitive markets, where it's always possible for somebody who doesn't like what somebody else says to go elsewhere with respect to their affections. So if you start looking at these cases, it's always striking. The damages that are sought are never for emotional distress, and therefore the additional cost of having to go two doors down in order to buy a cake from somebody else, please, we would like to get your honest $7. That's the private harm that they sue for. And then in the public space, what happens is you get these programs for re-education, for shutting people down, massive fines, and so forth. And that is a very dangerous kind of situation. So if I'm an evangelical Christian, and I'm looking at the way the world is, and I see the kind of pressure that's being put against me, then as somebody who essentially is trying to look at the larger world, I'm going to see the Israelis as embattled, and I'm going to tend to give them the kind of support that they might not otherwise get under other circumstances. So I think that's probably much closer to the source of what's going on. And, you know, it's a funny kind of situation. There's lots of sympathy on these kinds of issues, lots of political support. It's not as though these two groups meet together so that you have some kind of a situation where they're joint religious services or joint activities. I think it's really just a kind of a conscious parallelism in which each group recognizes that the other has a set of beliefs that's consistent with its own, and that one would think the world would be a lot better place if the notions of toleration were extended a bit more broadly, so that somebody can do something that you really disapprove of and you really don't like, but if it's not a direct threat to your physical safety, then they're not going to intervene and start to move against you. That would be, I think, a better world to live in. 1,000 points of light is one way that some people start to describe it. But it's quite clear to me that there is a rising form of intolerance. And I link these two things together. I think it's much easier for somebody to make strong attacks against somebody else in terms of the international arena if you're prepared to say, we're not going to let them thrive in the domestic arena, and to open their business up in one kind of a way. And so I actually come around and saying, I don't know whether I like Chick-fil-A or not, but the last thing I would want to do is not to go there, because I think in effect that they are run by religious individuals. I felt the same thing about Hobby Lobby and the controversy over contraceptives and so forth. I do think that on the right, there are some people, the alt-right, who are quite intolerant, but I think they're relatively weak. I think on the left, there are a lot more people with a lot more intolerance. And when somebody like Paul Krugman, whose judgment I never trust, starts to say he's only worried about anti-Semitism on the right and not about the left, I think in effect that that's the kind of institutional blindness that could get us into deeper trouble.
We know that, as you said earlier, Jewish voters in America tend to skew to the left. And this has been vexing to a lot of people, not the least of which are the many conservative intellectuals with Jewish roots. One of them, Norman Podhoretz, even wrote a book a few years back called Why Are Jews Liberals? How do you answer that question, Richard?
Well, I know what the answer is. The Jewish population is on average somewhat older than the national population. The median age is about 42. And I do think that the way people form their politics is what they think of the way in which the world was aligned during the formative ages. And if you start going back to the period which was my formative years, 1960, 1955, 1970, in that particular era, the dominant alliance that you saw was the Jewish Black Alliance, which was extremely strong on all sorts of issues, particularly those having to do with ending segregation in schools and in other forms of public life. And so I think what happened is at that particular time, that was a natural allegiance. And on the other side, what many Jewish people saw were large white Christian organizations whose chief partners really didn't want to hire them to become shareholders or partners in law firms and so forth. In the 1950s, when I was sort of growing up, I didn't know many Jewish firms, but it turns out there was one conspicuous firm, Paul Weiss, Rifkin, Wharton, and Garrison, as it became known, in which it turned out that you actually had a strong mix of Jewish and Christian partners. Randolph Paul was a very distinguished tax lawyer, but he was obviously a Christian. Garrison was a Christian, but Weiss, who died fairly soon, 1956, and then Judge Rifkin, Simon Rifkin, who lived for many, many years, they were Jewish. But most of the other firms were not. Remember when Bob Bork essentially went to Kirkland & Ellis, and he was responsible for getting them to hire a man named Howard Crane, who later became chairman of the firm and was the head of the board of trustees of the University of Chicago. This was 1957. And so you see that stuff. It's just very difficult for you to change your priors. Well, if you start looking at where the corporate world is today, I'm still sure that there are many Republican guys who are running cheese factories or pipe extruding companies one way or another who are on the right. But my Lord, if you start looking at the big companies, the Bezos of this world, the Bill Gates, the Mark Zuckerbergs and so forth, they're all very hard on the left. And I don't know, and I don't believe that most of them share these kinds of beliefs, but the landscape has changed. And I think it's very difficult for Jewish people to change because of the way they grew up. Again, just another kind of personal reflection. I didn't believe there were any Republicans in the world because I didn't know any. When Dwight Eisenhower ran against Adlai Stevenson in 1956, I was 13 years of age and pretty aware of what was going on politically. And if you did the local sampling, well, obviously Stevenson was going to win by 88-3 or something like that. But it turned out Eisenhower just swept the country in what Len Hall at the time called an avalanche, not a landslide. I still remember that on the news. Well, I mean, it's difficult to get these things. I do think now that some of these people are going to start to reconsider this because of the way in which the rhetoric started to escalate. I think that Nancy Pelosi now finds herself in this odd position of being the conservative inside the Democratic Party. The situation has gotten sufficiently odd that the Wall Street Journal ran a tongue-in-cheek editorial calling Speaker Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, because there's no question if you're starting to look about public FaceTime and so forth, this young charmer has managed to outperform the 77-year-old Speaker of the House by a ratio of about 10 to 1. And I think, in effect, there's a certain attractiveness to her style and charm, but if you actually listen to what the proposals are, they spell economic ruination for everybody. Whether this will translate itself into the religious thing, we're not sure of, but it is a distressing sign that she goes over to Great Britain and hobnobs around with Jeremy Corbyn, who's a rather notable anti-Semite, I think it's fair to say, and comes back and treats him as though he's a good guy. So I think in her case, it's naivete and ignorance, which I think is her general calling card that may drive this. But I do think that there are others on the left who are this way. And I think they are in part because they believe, just to finish the thought out, that Israel is now a neo-colonial power, an oppressor. And essentially, the anti-Jewish movement in Israel is essentially a liberation movement. If American Jews support that, then they are neo-colonialists as well. And we direct our fire at them. The fact that Israel is not apartheid, Israel is not South Africa of 1960, seems to be lost on people. And when they make the analogy of apartheid to Israel with such conviction and such firmness, it indicates the kind of a moral blindness which leaves me, frankly, very, very uneasy.
So that tees up quite well the last question that I was going to put to you, because while there was a fair bit of pushback on Congresswoman Omar from within the Democratic Party, you also had some people more or less defend what she said in a way that you couldn't really imagine someone, at least someone who was pursuing a political career, doing just a few years ago. And this does seem, as you suggest, to be part of a trend that we're seeing in the Democratic Party right now. Things that would have been regarded as unimaginably left-wing just, maybe an election cycle ago, are now things that oftentimes they're saying loudly and out in the open. What is your read on what's happening, whether it's within the Democratic Party or maybe within the broader culture, and why the hard left seems to have so much additional purchase compared to just a few years ago?
Yes, and I assume you're not just talking about the anti-Semitism issue.
Correct, this whole range of issues, yeah.
Medicare for all, the Green New Deal of one kind or another.
Free college, job guarantees.
Well, I mean, you know, what you do is it's real easy, to quote Ms. Ocasio-Cortez, to think that you can pay for anything if the way in which you pay for something is simply to print more dollar bills at the Fed, which is what she said before she pulled it down. And she really does not understand that the value of a dollar depends in large part on the number of dollars in circulation. And there's a kind of, as a first approximation, the rule that if the asset pool is X and the number of dollars of Y, you know what the ratio is. But if you then have to divide X by 10Y, it turns out each dollar is going to depreciate by a factor of 10. And if you really play the game so that nobody believes that the last new tranche of money is the final one, then you're going to start to have the kind of hyperinflation that drives a country like Venezuela to its knees. And I don't think she even understands all of that. The obvious question is, if we could always finance things by issuing new paper, why would we even have a tax on anything? We could always do it in this particular way. And it's because money is essentially a fractional claim on assets. And if there are more dollars, your fraction of the claim per dollar starts to go down. There's just no understanding of that. I mean, I've had the privilege slash misfortune to meeting Bernie Sanders one time at a dinner at the University of Chicago. And the level of ignorance that he displayed about economic affairs was one of the most frightening things that I've ever seen in my adult professional life. I mean, he was so convinced that everything on Wall Street was corrupt that the only thing you had to do was to denounce them and to put forward the alternative. No idea that scarcity really matters. And so I'll just take one idea, which I think illustrates this. These characters do not know what the phrase trade-off at the margin start to mean. So let's just take the question about education. If I'm paying for my particular education, I'm going to be pretty careful, maybe not perfect, but careful, to see that I'm going to get the value out of my education, which is worth more than I have to put into it. And I'll take into account the cash I have to pay. I'll take into account the schoolwork I have to do. I'll take into account the opportunity cost of what is going to be lost. And what you will do is you'll see some people do it now, some do more, some do less, some defer it, and so forth, because everybody's trying to figure out in their own way how to make marginal revenues equal to marginal cost. Well, now what you do is you tell them one component of your cost goes to zero, and then do you have to assume that they're going to behave exactly the same way so that all that changes is the financing but not the behavior? Well, of course that's not what's going to happen. And now it turns out that if you're spared the financial burden, people who before would have said education was too costly will start to take it. So they start to go into these institutions. How do you take care of them? Well, you got the marginal cost problem on the other side. As the number of enrollees starts to increase, the marginal cost of the new students coming in who are weaker than the old student is unfortunately going to start to rise. And so what you have to do is you have to see a benefit curve that's going down, 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 a cost curve that's going up, up, up. In a market economy where the two lines cross, this tends to be where you get the behavior. In this situation, the benefits could be close to zero and the social cost could be very, very high. But so long as somebody else is paying for it, you'll do it. There's no awareness that these behavioral changes will follow from the incentive. So there is the famous line from Margaret Thatcher, is socialism is really wonderful until you start running out of other people's money. And what she really meant by that is there is systematic overconsumption of all goods under these circumstances. Now, is there a problem with having a market-based economy? The answer to that question, I'm sorry to say, Troy, is yes, there is a real problem. Is she the only one who knows it? Is Bernie Sanders the only one who knows it? No. Why do universities have the following very simple situation? They have all sorts of charitable scholarships and so forth of one kind or another. Why is that? Because there's some people out there who say, if I can pick the student to whom I'm going to give the money, then I will take somebody who's cash poor. either make a grant or a loan in the hope that that financing will allow them to alter their lives. But it's a vast difference between having people look very closely to whom they're giving the money to see that they meet these requirements to a situation where you give it to everybody unquestioning and put the burden off on people who have no right to say whether things are going to happen or not. So one of the canards about markets is the only thing that matters in them is essentially the ability to pay by the individuals who receive the good. But a market is much more subtle than that. If there are voluntary people who are willing to fund other individuals, the transaction is voluntary. It's perfectly legitimate, even if the only benefit that the donor gets is name recognition or a warm glow from having done a good deed. So when you have somebody like Bernie Sanders or Ms. AOC who know absolutely nothing about how anything in this world works, it's real easy to start to imagine that you can get rid of one problem without creating another. But there's a very simple theorem here, and I'll end on this note, which is the world is dominated by conceptions of scarcity. And when you have scarcity, there are going to be some goods that really value, and they're not going to be satisfied. Some near good deals have to go out. And what budgets do is they force people to prioritize what they're prepared to pay for. And if it turns out there are two things that I like a lot, one I like 12 and one I like 8, and I have $10 left to spend on one of the two of them, I'm going to let the $8 good disappear in order to get the $12 good. If I had more money, I might buy both. And so what you try to do is to increase wealth so that the opportunities start to increase. And these proposals just have exactly the opposite effect. You can turn this country into Venezuela. Remember, Venezuela was one of the richest countries in the world before they engaged in this socialist experiment. And it's just a systematic structural mistake. And it's not just the fact that the politics turn totalitarian. It's also the fact that the economics turns to be completely destructive. And I think the American left wing is completely illiterate when it comes to economic stuff, and I put a large part of the blame on the way in which colleges and universities are educated today. If you look at the numbers, it turns out that probably on the left, you have 90% of the faculty working in the humanities and the soft social sciences in many cases, and this turns out a generation of youth which is not prepared to understand how difficult it is to run the world well and do not understand how much care and attention it took to build up the institutions that we now have and to have these blithe statements, well, we could always replace it with something better. That form of ignorance leads to social destruction, not to social prosperity.
You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting definingideas at hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.